Hello, everyone. I am Jennifer Jones with the Barbara and Richard Somme Center for Gerontological Excellence, housed in the University of Iowa's College of Nursing in beautiful Iowa City, Iowa. Welcome to Embracing the Journey of Aging, where we will discuss all things related to aging. The mission of the Somme Center is to promote optimal aging and to improve the quality of life for all older adults and their caregivers. Featured on our podcast, you will hear the voices of our Somme Center Director, Dr. Harleah Buck, Samantha Whitrock, our Somme Center Coordinator, our Administration and Communications Coordinator, Susan Trey, and from me, Jen Jones, Program Coordinator for our Optimal Aging Initiative. We hope you enjoy our conversations with Somme Center friends, partners, donors, and other members of the Somme Center as we are all embracing the journey of aging.
Everyone, and welcome to the Embracing the Journey of Aging podcast with the Somme Center. I am Susan Trey, the Somme Center's Administrative and Communications Coordinator, and today I am joined with Dr. Keila Herr, who works in the College of Nursing here at the University of Iowa College of Nursing. Everyone, we can go ahead and just jump right in. If you just want to start by introducing yourself to the podcast, and then we can just continue.
Yep. So, as Susan said, I'm Keila Herr. I have been a professor in the College of Nursing this is my 37th year, actually, so I've been here for a long time. I have been in nursing a lot longer than that, but came to the college in 1987, and for the reason of wanting to develop a research program in the area of, well, I didn't know my area at the time, but I wanted to be a scientist and learn those skills, and so Iowa was a great place to do that. So I've been here and focusing on geriatrics, and geriatric pain in particular has my area of focus.
Mm-hmm. So I guess one of the questions I'd like to get into is just so people can kind of learn your background a bit more is, where are you from?
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, I'm from Iowa, and I grew up in the Amana Colonies, which is a German community. Mm-hmm. So lived my life there, but after I graduated from high school and went off to college, I went to Missouri, lived there for about 15 years, lived in Texas for about 8 years when I got my graduate degrees there, and then returned back to Missouri before I moved back to Iowa and started my academic career here at Iowa. Mm-hmm. So, you know, have firm Iowa ethics, which I think is part of why Iowa is such an appealing place for me to be and why I've stayed here so long.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So you've kind of been around a lot of different places. What part of Missouri did you live in?
Kirksville, which is in northeast Missouri, small community. Mm-hmm. They had Northeast Missouri State at the time. Now it's Truman University, which was a teaching university. Mm-hmm. And so when I was there, I was really, it was just all about teaching and leadership in that role, but not doing research. Mm-hmm. And so after about 12 years there, I decided I needed to make a move to be able to position myself for future opportunities in my career.
Mm-hmm. And what about in Texas?
I was in Austin, at the University of Texas in Austin. Two different periods. I went there initially for my master's degree in 76, and then went back in 82 to do my doctorate in nursing, but with a focus on educational administration. And then after that, went back to Missouri as on a sabbatical, so I had to pay back some time, and then looked at new opportunities after that time was up.
I guess you may have kind of touched on this a little bit, but why did you go into your chosen career field?
So initially in high school, I was trying to explore what I wanted to do, and I did candy striping, which I don't think they do that anymore, but it was an opportunity to work in the hospital, basically as a volunteer, running errands and doing things for patients, and I just really enjoyed that environment and setting. And then was looking at career opportunities where I could make a difference, try to improve the lives of people, and also be in relationship with people. And so nursing, you know, seemed like an ideal field for me to go into. So that brought me into nursing. And then also, in the early parts of my nursing career, you know, had exposure to different populations, and caring and working with older people just was a natural draw. You know, I worked as a nursing assistant in the the long-term care setting and just really enjoyed the opportunity to work with older people. And so that kind of narrowed my interests to the group of people that I wanted to work with. So I got my master's in med-surg nursing with a focus on gerontology. And then after that, my clinical work was in orthopedics and primarily orthopedics, where most of my clients or patients were older at the time. And then also worked in the nursing home setting for a while in a nurse, just a staff nurse position, but really enjoyed it. But saw a lot of issues and gaps, which helped me to kind of identify where my focus was going to be as far as how I wanted to make a difference for older people's lives.
What were some of those gaps that you saw?
Well, the big one was pain. You know, so there's a lot of systems issues in long-term care in particular, taking care of older people and making sure they're getting quality of care. But within that and the systems, I just noticed so many people that were struggling with pain and not being recognized, not being treated effectively. But that really wasn't the big trigger, I think, that kind of drove my work into the area of pain management. When I was a new nurse, my grandmother got pancreatic cancer and, you know, a very short prognosis. And I moved home to help my mom take care of her. And during that period of time, she, you know, it was just really a matter of weeks. But we struggled to keep her comfortable. And it was because of a lot of misbeliefs and barriers to her care. Not only with her provider, who didn't provide adequate analgesia, but with her not wanting to take medication to resolve her pain. She's a stoic German, so, you know, suffering was something that she was comfortable with. And oddly, you know, she, when I talked about getting her stronger medication, she didn't want it, and it was because she was afraid of becoming addicted, which was just an odd thing to be worried about when you're in your final days and weeks of life. And so, to me, the priority is making sure that pain is relieved, especially at that in that phase of life. But we used non-drug techniques, you know, abdominal massage, distraction, cold, which helped to take the edge off things. But she suffered, you know, and so as I reflected back on that experience, it really motivated me to want to learn more myself, because I felt like I didn't have the skills at the time that I needed, and then to be able to educate and advocate for better pain management for older people.
Well, she wasn't the first one who's probably experienced stuff like that. I mean, I grew up, I had, my grandmother died of Alzheimer's, and then my grandfather had a stroke 6 months later, and so I saw the caregiving side of things at from a very early age, and like they were able to have like a live-in nurse, so they didn't have to go somewhere else. They could stay in their home, which is always a good thing, but a lot of times the pain management is always really hard, especially when they're older. Is something that I learned very early on. And kind of, you touched on this a little bit, but what was that caregiving experience like for you, just like you and your mother, and kind of how that's carried into your teaching?
You bet. You know, it was extremely rewarding, you know, to be able to be there and to provide that care for your grandparent or whomever. But because they've given so much to you in your whole life, to be able to be there and try to provide comfort and make sure that their transition to death is as peaceful and positive an experience as possible was really just amazing. You know, I did feel ill-equipped for some aspects of it, because even though I was a new nurse, I hadn't been in that kind of situation, and particularly at the time, pain education was pretty limited, and so I really felt that that was a big gap, and that's kind of led to a lot of the things that I've done in my career to try to improve that for other people. And when we talk about geriatricpain.org, you know, we've really tried to address the needs of caregivers and to help them to have resources to be able to carry out that role and feel more confident in being a caregiver and assuring that their loved ones are comfortable and getting the best care possible.
kind of also makes me think of just, like you kind of mentioned, like confidence is like having confidence in the person that you're caring for, because I guess I just never thought about it in that sense. Just, I've never really been a caretaker for someone before, but my parents are on the older side, so I imagine that it will become something that I do one day. But just having the confidence and knowing that what you're doing is helping them is really important too. I never really thought about it like that before.
Yeah, it's really important. And I'm sure that if you observe your parents' relationship with your grandmother and them taking care of them, you know, the communication from the person that you're caring for of appreciation and value for what's being given to them. You know, it's interesting as I've thought about the transition of life. You know, when you're younger and your parents and grandparents do everything to make sure that you're in a good place and having a positive life. And then as we age, and now I'm getting closer to the other end of it, and I've had the opportunity, you know, to care for my grandmother and then my parents, as both of them died from cancer as well. But what was incredibly rewarding to me was when my parents went through their experiences, because of the work that I've done in my career to develop knowledge and science to improve pain care and to educate others and to try to change practices, I was able to do, you know, a much more effective job with them than I was with my grandmother. And they both had peaceful deaths, and their pain was managed at the end of their lives. But it's not that easy, you know. It was even challenging for me to manage that whole experience with all of my knowledge and experience, which just reinforced how much work there is to be done to help other people that don't have healthcare background and are put into the situation where they want to be able to make sure their loved ones are well cared for.
I guess you kind of already touched on that. How did you become interested in gerontology? Is there anything else you'd like to touch on that as far as gerontology?
Yeah, no, I think I kind of highlighted the main things that drew me into it. And probably one of the other things was what in my nursing training, when I was on the pediatric unit, I couldn't do it.
Really?
It was very uncomfortable because at the time, you know, we inflicted a lot of pain with the approaches that we did to treatments. There wasn't the preventive treatment of pain and prevention of pain. A lot of shots and injections and things that cause pain, and crying babies and children is just really hard for me. And so I just knew after that rotation that that wasn't the population that I was best suited to.
I can understand that, yeah, because I guess in infants especially, like, they don't understand what's going on. They're just like, I'm just laying on this table, and I mean, yeah, when they're older, they probably won't remember it, but as someone who's giving them the shot or treating them, who's having to, like, basically cause the pain in order to help them get better, that has to be really hard.
Yeah,
that would be hard for me, too, because I think whenever I speak to students, a lot of them do go into pediatrics. And I'm thinking, oh, well, they like kids. They think kids are cute. But I never thought about it from that perspective of, like, you're having to inflict pain on this child in order to help them feel better.
Yeah, and there is still some of that. But we've come a long way as far as how to intervene with children and using all different approaches in interacting with them and their families to try to really minimize the pain that they experience. And we've got some really cool things that they're able to use now before injections so that it doesn't hurt or it's very minimal. So it's not the way it was, you know, when I was a student. So, and I think being able to implement those for people that like working with that population, it's a much more positive experience now.
I agree. So you mentioned geriatric pain. So going into that, I would like to get more details on it, just even just from the things that I know already. It's just, why was the website created? You kind of touched on, like, your experience with, you know, the gap and everything, but if you wanted to go into that too.
So I'm going to just step back a little bit to talk about some of the work, you know, that I've been able to do during my career that has kind of led to the development of geriatric pain. Mm-hmm. So has, you know, I became a researcher and worked to develop tools and approaches for improving the assessment and treatment of pain in older people and ways to get those implemented into practice by nurses or healthcare providers, wherever they are. I had opportunities to work at the national level with professional organizations that are also focused on optimal aging and providing quality care to older people, and for which pain was a condition that is a significant problem. And so with those organizations, I was able to participate in and lead initiatives to develop clinical practice guidelines, position statements that provide recommendations for providers about the best ways to assess and treat pain in the population. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of that work that has gone on, but the challenge then is translating that so that nurses are using it, physicians are using that information. And so geriatricpain.org was initiated as a way to provide best practice resources and tools for clinicians to help them to increase their knowledge and to be able to apply those practices more readily in their setting. So initially, geriatric pain became, it was one element of a big initiative that was sponsored by the National Hartford Foundation. Back in the day, this was back in the early, or in the 90s, I think, or early 2000s, the Hartford Foundation established Centers of Geriatric Excellence around the country, and there was five initial centers. Iowa was one. There was one in Oregon, one in California, UC San Francisco, Oregon Health Science, University of Arkansas Medical Sciences, University of Pennsylvania. Was that five?
I believe so. I'm familiar with the Arkansas one just because of where I'm from.
Okay. And so those centers had broad initiatives to increase actually the workforce by bringing in new people into geriatrics and educating them, helping them to become scientists to advance the science of geriatric nursing. That group then became involved in an initiative called the National Nursing Home Collaborative that was focused on improving the quality of care in nursing homes. Mm-hmm. One of the projects within that was trying to address pain in long-term care. And so there were leaders identified from each of the geriatric centers of excellence that were interested and had expertise in pain. Mm-hmm. And I ended up being the lead of this steering committee to develop geriatric pain as a resource, mm-hmm. as one strategy. There was a lot of things around it that we did at the time, but basically it was to create this resource and then to disseminate it and try to get it used, you know, in nursing homes. But it had a very nursing home focus initially, mm-hmm. and it was just for clinicians. Mm-hmm. So it was launched, I think, about 2011. Mm-hmm. And then about 10 years after its initial launch and use, and we updated it once, and then the national centers were relatively disbanded and not funded mm-hmm. anymore by the Hartford Foundation. Some of those centers were able to have endowments and resources to continue, which Iowa was one that was, mm-hmm. you know, we were so blessed to be able to have an investment to have the Somme Center continue. So we were looking for a home for geriatricpain.org then at the time, and we were able to bring it to Iowa, where now it's a part of the Somme Center, and but yet still a national and international resource. Mm-hmm. But there's been a lot of development since we've brought it here and mm-hmm. been working on it. And the last few years, we have a different editorial team that's been working on reviewing it and changing the infrastructure, and that's you know, the work of the SOME Center staff, which has been amazing in helping to transition it, creating a new platform, you know, developing a new look, recreating all the resources so that they have, you know, a unified theme, identifying where the gaps are in resources and what needed to be updated, because science changes, practices change, so time needs to go into that. And then adding some sections to the resource so that it would be useful not just for clinicians, but also for older adults themselves, and then caregivers. There's a whole caregiver section now of resources that are tailored for family caregivers, really, and with a high emphasis on addressing the needs of family caregivers who have persons with dementia. So, I mean, that's a challenging group to be able to recognize and treat their pain. So initially, the geriatric pain was housed with Sigma Theta Tau, which is an international nursing organization. And we had funding from the Hartford Foundation, from the Mayday Fund, which is the nonprofit that focuses on pain. The University of Iowa contributed, and Golden Living, which was a nursing home collaborative, gave funds to the initial development of the resource. Since we've brought it to Iowa, we also, you know, have been so blessed by the Mayday Foundation. They gave us funding to support the transition because there was a lot of infrastructure work that needed to be done in moving it and getting it established in a new organization on a new platform. So they've been great in providing that funding. The university contributed funding through, you know, my time to be able to work on that. And then probably the most recent funding was from the Bowers Education and Outreach Fund, which was established to develop the caregiver section. And so, you know, over probably a five-year period initially, we really worked to create this whole new section, identify resources, develop resources. And then we've gone through an update of the clinician section because it had been lagging through all this transition. And so that's been our work for the last 2 years to get everything, the new website and all the resources to a point where we were ready to do a new launch, which we were able to do in June this past year. So we're in the process of promoting and trying to disseminate the resources to anybody who has need and interest in this topic.
When, I guess, kind of going into my next question, I'm kind of skipping ahead because you kind of talked about this, and some of the pages that I have seen on the website have come to mind. Like, one of the ones that I thought was so important was there was a page about helping caregivers communicate the needs of the ones that they're caring for to healthcare professionals. Because even just for me to come home and tell my husband, like, this is what the doctor said about this, it's actually very difficult to communicate, like, back and forth about what's being said. And he also happens to be a healthcare worker, so he gets it. So I thought that that page was also very helpful, just, and that was one that's been shared, and just because that is something that a lot of caregivers, especially because a lot of them are probably family members who are trying to look at the symptoms of their the one that they're caring for, and then having to pass that along to a nurse or a doctor and say, these are the issues that they're having. So I definitely feel like that that one's making a difference. And kind of coming to the question of, and I'll go back to the other ones too, is like, who can use the resources and like, how can they be used?
You bet. So to touch on what you mentioned about the tools to be prepared to communicate with providers. Some of the resources that we have on the caregiver section related to that came out of some work that I've been able to do with Cornell University. And we have an R01, which is a federal grant that's funded right now, to test the implementation of a toolkit that we developed, which is focused on, it's for family caregivers, but it's on, you know, how do you recognize pain in someone with dementia, and how do you then advocate for your loved one? And it's through the communication process with, with the provider, and gathering important information, capturing it in on a tool so that you don't forget what needs to be shared and what are the important things that you need to communicate with the provider. And so that that toolkit is on the website and is fully available for anybody that wants to use it. So I agree with you that just knowing, you know, what does pain look like, what are the behaviors and things that as a caregiver I need to observe for, isn't enough, you know, because you'd need to take that next step to try to get the support for interventions to relieve pain. And not all providers are that knowledgeable about pain in people with dementia either. So often, and I found in my own experiences, I really still have to advocate that, you know, I think my person's having pain. And this is what I'm seeing. This is, if they don't have dementia, you know, this is what they're telling me. This is how they're rating their pain. This is how it's affecting their life and their ability to do things. And with dementia, you look for things that are related to that if they can't communicate to us. But then the next step is getting the provider on board so that they will help make sure that you're able to relieve pain and manage the situation. So we have a whole section dedicated on communicating with providers and tools and resources that can be used there. But I was thinking about this, the whole site itself, and there are tools and resources that touch on almost everybody. You know, so we have the whole section for clinicians, and in our revision of the website, you know, we moved from language about nurses to healthcare professionals or clinicians because it really applies not just to nurses, but physicians, physicians assistants, nurse practitioners, whoever the providers are, in whatever setting they're in. If they're caring for older people, most of the tools that we have are relevant and applicable. But so in the clinician section, you know, there are tools that they can use for their own practice. There are tools that they can integrate into their organizations, into their policies and procedures, and a section on educating staff. So there are tools with PowerPoints and, you know, everything they would need to be able to train staff on how to assess and treat pain. And so there, it's just, you know, a whole toolkit for clinicians to help them. The older adult section is of use for older people. You know, they can go, if they're having pain, they can come to the site, look at the older adult section, and there's information on how do I communicate my pain to others. You know, helping them to get familiar with the tools that clinicians use on evaluating pain and how pain's impacting their function. So getting familiar with those tools is as a older person yourself is valuable. We have a whole section of fast facts, which are kind of short tools on topics like different pain conditions or different types of interventions, which is basically what it is. This is what you need to know. You know, is how you use it. These are safety considerations and links. We have a whole section of links to other resources for more information. So I think that's valuable for the patient themselves. And in the caregiver section, you know, for family caregivers for sure, other caregivers like licensed providers, you know, nursing assistants could go there as well. But it's really targeted more at the family caregiver, the unpaid professional. And again, there's just a wealth of, again, these short, short tools. There's also longer tools that give more detail about pain conditions and things you might want to know about different pain problems, but so useful there. Another use of the site is for educators. So healthcare professional education can use the resource in working with their students to educate them, provide them with tools that they can use in their clinicals, for example. I think the caregiver tools are really also useful for clinicians because as a clinician, when you're working with an older person or with their caregiver, you could refer them to the site and to the caregiver tools so that they could access those or print them out and give them the ones that are relevant. But it, you know, can also be used for that group as well. So I'm trying to think across the spectrum, and I think there's a little bit of something for everybody.
There really is. I think when you mentioned the fast facts, that those are pages that I've seen, mm-hmm. and I mean, there are truly fast facts about everything from, I think, like eye pain, mm-hmm. using like hot or cold methods, mm-hmm. just to name a few that I can think of. Yeah. And because one of the things is, especially if someone doesn't work in healthcare, but they mm-hmm. are a caregiver, they have to be able to understand what they're yeah. reading. It has to be digestible for them to read and understand in order to relay it back to the yep. actual care, the care healthcare provider, really. Because mm-hmm. you know, if they are caring for someone with dementia, like
yep.
that can be really tough. And then communicating, well, this is what I'm witnessing, yes. and the care, and if they're not, mm-hmm. you know, giving it back to them in a way that the healthcare provider understands, it can get really frustrating with the communication.
Yeah.
I can imagine. And so those fact sheets I could see being so, so helpful.
And what we tried to do in the fact sheets, you know, we started with most of them, we started with the clinician version, but then mm-hmm. rewrote them so that they are more for a lay user. Mm-hmm. You know, so looked at the vocabulary and how mm-hmm. we presented things. And everything that is on the caregiver site, we had a focus group, well, both a focus group and also a group of caregivers that worked through the web resources themselves and gave us feedback on, you know, the usefulness, the understandability, you know, did they, the level of detail and information to help us to refine how we were preparing these for caregivers. So at least the group that we had to review and give us feedback, you know, felt very positive about the resources and the leveling of how we prepared those.
Mm-hmm. That kind of has me go back to another question about, like, who worked on the site, because mm-hmm. I know it sounds like a lot of people have been involved. I think even since before I came to the right. SOMA Center, I think you guys have been having meetings about this yep. for so long. And just, yeah, just who's worked on the site mm-hmm. and just what that has looked like over time, I guess until, like, the most recent launch back in June that you've had.
So initially, when we started the development of the site, it was the five people from mm-hmm. the five Hartford centers, and we were the steering committee for its development. Mm-hmm. And we basically did a concept map of what we thought needed to be on the site. Mm-hmm. So then, once we had all these topics that we wanted to address, it was a matter of finding, you know, are there existing resources and tools and that are evidence-based mm-hmm. and high quality? You know, that's always an issue when you go to a website, is this stuff just put out there by anybody?
Yeah.
And we wanted this site to be grounded in science and evidence and best practice recommendations. So we searched and evaluated what was already out there and things that were good and appropriate by the criteria that we used in rating things. We sought permission to include them on the site. Mm-hmm. And then there was a lot of things that weren't in a format that was user-friendly and concise. So we developed a lot of resources, and that was done by the steering committee or other people that we brought in that had mm-hmm. expertise in pain to help to develop some of those tools and resources. Mm-hmm. Then, and so the infrastructure, which is the other part of it, you know, was managed by the staff at Sigma Theta Tau. They helped mm-hmm. in the actual developing of the resource then. Then when we moved it to Iowa, there have been a number of people that are in staff positions that have, you know, been critical in the infrastructure development. Mm-hmm. The earlier SOMA team and now the current SOMA team, you know, we wouldn't be able to have the site if we didn't have that infrastructure support. Mm-hmm. And so that's been critical. And then most of the work since we brought it to Iowa has been two editors, Christopher mm-hmm. Cucci and Deb Connolly, who are mm-hmm. clinical experts in the area of pain and have had years and years of experience working mm-hmm. with older people. And they've been involved in developing the new resources, updating our older resources. And we reach out to, and again, we continue to look for other resources that exist. It's not, we don't want to develop everything from scratch. We want to use things that are good. And so we've continued to check with the people that have developed stuff and incorporated those materials into the site as well. And I've also had some student involvement, you know, in looking at the site and looking at things that they could contribute for a smaller focus. The class on care of the patient in pain that I teach, I've had an assignment where I've asked students to go to the website, look at the tools, and I had them look at the tools for the older patient themselves, and it critically evaluate them. You know, how does this communicate information? What are there strategies that would be more effective in communicating the message? You know, how current is the information, and are there resources that need to be added? And so was able to give students an opportunity to participate in the development for some of the sections. And so I think gave them opportunities, but also helped, you know, look at ways to keep the site current.
That was a question that I popped into my head while you were talking, was if you were utilizing it in your classroom, because considering like the education that you've had and then the reason behind geriatric pain and then just utilizing it in your class, I guess what has that change been like from your education to seeing what you're teaching now with through geriatric pain?
Well, it's just been an incredible resource to be able to share. And I've used it in my classes, but I've also shared it with, you know, our undergraduate faculty that teach the geriatric component of class and their clinicals. And then our nurse practitioner students, you know, to be able to have it as a resource for them to turn to. So it's mainly been, I think, integrating it, increasing awareness that this is a resource that can help, you know, in your practice, whether it's in the things that you're doing yourself as a clinician, in educating the people around you and advocating for better pain care, or sharing tools with families or older adults. So mainly from that perspective. But I think it's been a great resource. And in the course I teach, I have a section on aging and pain. And so, you know, it's part of their assignments and questions to go exploring and consider how this can be, you know, useful to them and to others.
Yeah, that must be really interesting just to see how it's changed, like what needs have changed over time. I guess you touched on this a little bit, but kind of going into a bit more detail on who uses it, because one of the questions that I thought about was, you know, if someone became a caretaker today, like it's their first time, their mother or father is experiencing a ton of pain and they come across geriatric pain, is like, how can they utilize it to their benefit in order to help the person that they're caring for? Like, if they were to just to go to the homepage, where would you point them?
So one of the things that we added this past year were some little kind of orientation videos about the different sections. And so for the caregiver section, you know, it's a video of me kind of walking them through the site to orient them to what's there. Because I think, I mean, ideally they would just explore everything, but sometimes that can be overwhelming. So I've kind of guide them through what's in each section and talk a little bit about how they might use those things. We also developed kind of an algorithm that's on the front page or in the initial section that kind of shows how you would use tools through the pain assessment intervention process. So, you know, initially is to recognize pain and to be able to communicate, evaluate it and communicate about it. And so we kind of have a diagram, and then that shows what section of the web you would go to find the assessment tools. And then when you get into intervention, you know, it talks about making decisions about drug treatment, non-drug treatment, which interventions might be appropriate for different conditions. And so it just, it's kind of just like a little algorithm that then guides them to different sections where they can get information. And we've talked about doing more yet of trying to create some scenarios, maybe taking a clinical case and walking them through how they might be able to use the different resources and which ones might be applicable, because there are a lot there. Mm-hmm. And when you get into the different, so the sites are organized into assessment, treatment, clinical resources, and communication with providers is for the caregiver section. but within each one of those, we've tried to include, you know, at least a couple sentences of guidance about what the different tools are in each section. But it might be in the future that we could develop, you know, more little video things like we're working today, but that are short and concise, but could talk about the different tools and how they might be applied.
I can see where that would be helpful, because if it were me, I feel like if I went to the site and I'm thinking I'm looking for something specific and I don't know where to start, and having that algorithm could be a huge help, because it kind of sounds like it's one of those kind of like trees. You click here, it takes you here. You click on this link, it takes you to this next one. Yeah, because it must be overwhelming, just all of the information that they can take in at once as far as pain management.
Yeah, I would agree. And there is a lot there. And and like with the fast facts, we've tried to organize them, you know, with the actual focus of the fast fact as the key information, so that, and they're kind of alphabetically oriented. But if you're not aware of what they are, you really kind of have to scroll through the topics to see the ones that are there. So there might be some ways to sub-organize that we just haven't had an opportunity to get to that point yet. But since we've just launched, you know, we have a plan for regular updating of the site, and that also would include getting more input from users about, you know, how useful the site is, what would they like to see that would have made it easier for them to find and use, what information would be the most useful.
Yeah, I think, has the user experience been very helpful to you guys?
Very much so, yeah. And it affirmed that the things that we did develop were useful. But we got some really good suggestions of things that were missing, things about language and wording that we were able to use in incorporating in the revisions to the documents and tools.
I find, especially in things like websites or even just communications in general, it's always a work in progress. Like,
absolutely.
You get to a point and then it's like, okay, well, we have these new updates that we have to create, or new process, or these new areas of pain management that we can introduce to people. I guess then going into my next question is, and you can drop into more detail on this, is just how people can use the resources once they find what they need. Like if it's dementia, if it's someone who is caring for someone with dementia, or as far as like communicating to healthcare providers, or maybe another sibling that's helping taking care of their parent. Just how the resources can be used to their benefit.
So the website is accessible, you know, on the computer, but it's also, it pops up on tablets and on the phone. So it's accessible in any format. So there could be some documents or resources that get called up, you know, in a need, when you have a need right away. But you can also, everything on the site, well, first of all, everything is free. I wanted to make sure that we communicated that point. The website was developed to be a free resource, so that there isn't, we're not trying to make money on it, and we want it to be accessible and useful to everybody. So anybody can access anything on it. The tools that are on there are downloadable, so somebody could download them on their computer and create a group of their own tools and resources that they found most valuable. So that's an option. The other, or print them out, is the other thing that a lot of people, I think, do, because they want to have the tool in their hand. But a lot of it is, I think, accessing the resource and just consuming it or reading it to get the information that they need. And then, as you've said, one of the sets of tools that I think is probably the most valuable after you learn about recognizing pain and mm-hmm. how to assess it and what are some of the interventions that you can do as a caregiver, but in preparing to share information, whether it's mm-hmm. with a family member who's also caring for them or to communicate with the provider. One of the tools that we found very valuable and that we've gotten a lot of positive feedback mm-hmm. on is using a pain diary, which, again, you could print this out and you record information about the person's pain, you know, and over time, so that you're seeing a record of whether behaviors are changing, whether their level of pain is getting worse, whether their function is improving or decreasing, and what when they have pain, you document what you did to try to resolve it and whether it improved. Mm-hmm. And so you can kind of have this running tool that captures what's worked and what hasn't worked, how their pain may change over time during the day. And so that diary has been a tool that we link to on most of the resources. Mm-hmm. The communication tools are also very valuable because it captures what caregivers are educated on as far as what they should be looking for, what behaviors they need to pay attention to, using tools that we have available to evaluate or to assess pain, determine if pain's present, mm-hmm. And how to you can capture that on the communication tool, keep making notes of the things that you need to ask the provider. What we find happens a lot is you get to the appointment, there's a short period of time, and you forget, you mm-hmm. know, what were the issues, what were the things that you saw, what are the problems related to pain that you need help resolving. Mm-hmm. And so identifying, I think the tool actually asks for, like, what are the top three questions that you mm-hmm. want answered about, you know, your person's mm-hmm. pain, either the recognition of it, understanding it, or treatment of it. Mm-hmm. And so there's a variety of topics on that resource that I would encourage printing out, mm-hmm. filling it out before every appointment so that you have that. We also have a pain chart, which is another useful tool that you graph the assessments that you do over time, which really then shows you this pattern of, okay, is pain staying under control, or are we seeing, you know, increases that are of concern? And sharing that with a provider also can be very helpful to look at what's going on and get some guidance on how to try to prevent and manage the pain that they're experiencing.
Mm-hmm. I think, yeah, the pain diary that you had mentioned and, like, mm-hmm. the chart, I think those are ones that I've come across the website mm-hmm. myself. And that's true. The amount of times that I've gone to a doctor's appointment thinking, okay, these are the things that I need to address, and I don't write mm-hmm. it down, mm-hmm. I'll forget something. I might remember two out of the three things yeah. that I need to address with my doctor. And then it's when I get to my car.
I know.
And I'm like, I forgot to ask this one question yeah. about this thing, and at that point you got to wait mm-hmm. till the next appointment. So, yes, exactly. I definitely see how those resources yeah. can be so helpful to yeah. people, because especially mm-hmm. if they're an older adult and they're kind of to a right. point where the person who advocates yeah. for them is their caregiver.
Right. Yeah, and that tool would be important. Not just for caregivers, but as mm-hmm. you said, we also have a version of it for the older adult themselves. Mm-hmm. And it's helping them to prepare for their physician or nurse practitioner PA appointment mm-hmm. so that they've captured the important information to show what their pain experience has been and then to identify those questions that they need answered.
It sounds like that also kind of helps with independence, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it helps especially. Them, empowers them to take mm-hmm. some ownership, which is important. You know, mm-hmm. self-management strategies are really a very important part of pain management of mm-hmm. older people's pain. And so advocating for yourself, mm-hmm. I think, is just critical today. You know, mm-hmm. you have to be educated, even as an older adult, on what your problems are. And what your potential solutions are, and then to discuss those with your provider to make sure you're making safe choices. Mm-hmm. You know, there's a lot of alternative treatments for pain that are available. And, you know, it's really important for providers to know, especially if you're taking homeopathy medications, herbal supplements that could interact with the medications that they're taking. So there's communication and sharing what you're doing, and self-managing is really important. And also to communicate what's worked for you before, so that the provider is aware of the things that have been effective when they're developing a treatment plan as well.
That's very true. I guess kind of going into the next thing, is there anything you'd like to add as far as geriatric pain, anything that you haven't talked about that you'd like to talk about?
You know, we've covered a lot of things related to it. I think our biggest challenge at this point is now disseminating it and getting it used. And so, you know, we're using social media. We've contacted major organizations that are invested in care of older people and promoting optimal aging. And those organizations have been really great because of our relationships in, you know, disseminating information to their members, posting links on their websites. But I think it's a continual challenging to get the information to the people that need it. Because of the name of it, if people search for geriatric pain, it pops up, you know, at the top of the search. But if you go in with a different search choice, you know, you may not find it. Unfortunately, you know, you can buy your way up so that you're always at the top. And we actually, we did that as a part when we first moved the site here. We actually, you know, hired a marketing company to help us to develop digital marketing approaches to get the site out. But you have to have financial resources because we're a free website. You know, we don't have income coming in. And so that's one of, you know, our goals is to continue to seek funders that want to donate to the site so that we could do more of that. You know, we can also do boosts on Facebook and social media. But again, and it's effective for the time that you're doing it. So I think over the long term, you almost need a stream of income so that you can continually boost and, you know, get the information out.
Because, yeah, that's true. You can buy your way to the top of of a search engine, but it can be costly. But do you know if other universities are using geriatric pain, and like other nursing colleges that are using it in classrooms?
Just through personal comments that they are, but we've not done any systematic, you know, way of really evaluating that. I know, you know, clinical sites and hospitals that use it. Actually, one of our editors that's responsible for the clinical site, you know, she's been a super user in her organization. And so, you know, we've also worked with NYU in their niche program. And, you know, so they are helping to promote it as a resource for their organizations that are member organizations. But we haven't done a, you know, a detailed evaluation of who is using it and where it's being used. Another organization that we're involved with, and the SOMI Center is the National Centers of Hartford, National Hartford Centers of Geriatric Nursing Excellence, or Excellence, And so there are schools of nursing that are member organizations that do work together as an organization, and so they've shared information about this as a resource as well. But I think it's just ongoing to keep it in people's minds, to make people aware of it, sharing information, you know, wherever we go, at conferences and other ways. We participated with AARP in a project a year ago, it was last spring, to develop resources for caregivers about pain in older adults. And through that, we developed a series of six videos on, you know, pain assessment, low-risk interventions, high-risk interventions, communicating with providers. And within each of the videos, there's links to geriatricpain.org. We were able to then, as a spin-off, and this is on our website as well, if you go to the caregiver site, we had a spin-off series of articles in AJN on topics related to assessing and managing pain in older adults. And fast, kind of a fast fact tool within that for family caregivers, which also links to geriatricpain.org. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of ways we've been trying to position this as a resource mm-hmm. to help people. And those tools and articles are also all linked on the caregiver side of geriatric pain. So we've kind of had a symbiotic mm-hmm. relationship of trying to help get the information out to those who need it.
I've never been on the teaching side of things, but is there a way to get something, whether it's geriatric mm-hmm. pain or something similar, incorporated into curriculum for nursing students mm-hmm. or even just healthcare? Is there a way to do that, or is that like, does it get a bit tricky?
It is tricky. Even in our own school, mm-hmm. you know, curriculums are very full and content time for students is hard, which is why I think having a resource like geriatric pain that students can turn to, that faculty can turn to, has a resource that students can use and explore that, you know, you may not use it in the moment in a classroom, but on clinical I could see, you know, using it mm-hmm. by, you have a patient with a problem with pain, mm-hmm. you could call up on your phone, mm-hmm. go to the yes. website, look up the topic and, you know, see what you could find that would give you, this is the current practice recommendations for how mm-hmm. we could address this. But it is hard getting content in curricula on the topic of pain, and pain and aging in particular is, you know, it's just not easy. So I think that's, you know, an asset. Geriatric pain is an asset because it kind of captures kind of cutting edge work that can be used in a variety of different ways.
Mm-hmm. So you've touched a lot on just your career, where you're from, and your background, and your interest in gerontology, and just all the work on geriatric pain that's been done. So one of the things that I always like to kind of help wrap up the episode mm-hmm. is just words of advice to younger generations out there about aging, whether it's like nursing students, someone mm-hmm. who might be caring for someone, just any advice that you might have.
Sure. Well, choosing aging focus as a career, mm-hmm. I think, is one I have to recommend that.
Yeah.
So, and I just would reflect that having a career in the area of trying to improve the quality of life of older people mm-hmm. has been extremely rewarding. And when you look at our society and our aging population, the challenges that we face in our healthcare system, older adults are a huge part mm-hmm. of what needs to be addressed, and then there's a lot of opportunities to improve the quality of life of older people by focusing your work, you know, in this area. And not everybody does, and even those who like to work with children, there's so much to think about as far as what happens as children and how it impacts mm-hmm. them when they age. So when we talk about optimal aging, it crosses the lifespan, mm-hmm. and all along the way, as nurses and clinicians, we need to be thinking about the end game and having longevity and quality of life as we age at the mm-hmm. end. But it is an incredibly rewarding field. And then for, you know, I think about for myself, as you age, mm-hmm. you start seeing the application of yes. what you're doing to you, to your parents, you know, your grandparents. And so learning all you can about aging and how you as an individual can help the older generation and those that you love. But it's mm-hmm. it's definitely an area of a rewarding career.
Yes, that's something that I found being in my role in the SOME Center is just mm-hmm. the idea of aging and aging optimally, because mm-hmm. I mean, it's always about what can I do now in my 20s that'll help me when I'm in my 40s or 30s.
Exactly.
And I think, you know, when you're young, especially just from my experience, I didn't think about that stuff mm-hmm. years ago, because I was like, oh, I'm fine. Yeah. Like, I'm wearing sunscreen, you know, I go on my walks, you know, mm-hmm. but it's like as you get older, you know, it gets harder to do mm-hmm. certain things. Like, my mom decided she wanted to try and start running. Well, she's in her 60s, mm-hmm. and she ended up getting shin splints, and the doctor was like, it might be best if you don't do that.
Yeah.
And so it's, you know, and it was from mm-hmm. that experience that I learned, well, if I want to be able to do certain things at an age,
mm-hmm.
I need to be doing them now.
Yep.
And so, like, that's one of the things that motivates me just to even just take care of myself
right.
physically and mentally.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And then also, though, to how do we adapt mm-hmm. to those changes as we age? You know, okay, so maybe in our 60s or 70s, we shouldn't be running, but there is a lot of other mm-hmm. exercises that we can do that promote health. You know, surprisingly, when you look at the non-drug interventions for pain,
mm-hmm.
the very best thing that one can be doing is exercising.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maintaining flexibility, strength, balance, and Tai Chi is a mm-hmm. great, you know, example. That there's a lot of evidence that mm-hmm. it not only improves those aspects of your health, but it does reduce pain as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, to prevent pain or to be able to manage it, staying as fit as we can and doing whatever exercise mm-hmm. you're able to do at whatever stage of our lives as we age is mm-hmm. important.
Yeah, my dad recently got an e-bike as like a form of exercise.
Yeah.
And so it's
me
like,
too. And it keeps
yeah.
you biking because
it does.
You can. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Great.
I think the next question that I have is just how can people connect with you if they had questions about geriatric pain or
sure.
wanted to use it as a mm-hmm. resource in a classroom?
Yeah, I would love to hear from anybody that mm-hmm. would like to have more information or talk to me about the site or anything related to pain mm-hmm. and aging. And so I can be reached by email at keela-herr@uiowa.edu. They could come to the University of Iowa and go to the Somme Center, and I'm, mm-hmm. you know, linked there, or go to the faculty directory. You know, you could find me there as well. But absolutely would love to hear from people and suggestions.
Mm-hmm.
If they're looking at the website, you know, if they had issues or found gaps that mm-hmm. something wasn't there that would have been helpful, that's the kind of feedback that we would really love to have so that we can continue to improve the site.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much, Keela, for this time and mm-hmm. talking about geriatric pain and your background in nursing and experiences that you've had. So if you guys want to reach her, I will have that information in the show notes, any emails or also links to geriatric pain and any other websites that we've mentioned and maybe even some specific quick facts. And just thank you so much for embracing mm-hmm. the journey of aging with us. See you in the next episode.
Thank you so much for listening to Embracing the Journey of Aging. If you liked what you heard, please follow us on our social media pages. You can also find more information on our website. If there is a specific topic you would like us to talk about, or if you have any comments, feel free to email us at somme-center@uiowa.edu. Remember, Somme is spelled C-S-O-M-A-Y. All other information will be in our show notes. Until next time, we hope you are embracing the journey of aging.